This is a reading of the set of lectures, The Inner Experience of Evolution. And this is Lecture 2, The Inner Aspect of the Sun Embodiment of the Earth, given in Berlin, November 7th, 1911. You will have gathered from the previous lecture that to describe each of the three stages of development preceding the creation of our own Earth is extremely difficult. We have seen that to do so we must first build up the concepts and ideas needed to reach such strange and distant states of our cosmic development. I have already pointed out that no description of the ancient Saturn period and the planetary embodiments of our Earth following it, such as, for example, the description given in Title and Outline of Occult Science, is exhaustive. In that book, I had to be content to clothe the subject in pictures drawn from what is familiar and close at hand, for the book was meant to be accessible to the public and not too shocking. The description given in An Outline of Occult Science is not exactly inaccurate, but pictorially it is dipped in illusion or Maya. One must work through the illusion to penetrate to the truth. For example, ancient Saturn may be described as a heavenly body that did not consist of those components we know as earth, water, or air, but was made up entirely of warmth, and this is correct within certain limits. Likewise, any reference to space is only a pictorial description, for as we saw in the last lecture, not even time existed on ancient Saturn. There was no space on ancient Saturn, at least not in our sense of that term, while time first came into being then. When we put ourselves in the context of ancient Saturn, then, we are in a realm of spaceless eternity. Thus, if we attempt to picture this, we must be clear that it is only a picture. Were we then to have entered ancient Saturn's quote-unquote space, we would have found no substance there dense enough to be described as gas. There would have been only warmth and coldness. In reality, we could not speak of coming out of one part of space and entering another. There was only the feeling of moving between warmer and colder conditions. Even clairvoyants who imagined themselves within the time period of ancient Saturn experience only the impression of the ebb and flow of spaceless warmth. But this impression is only the outer veil of the Saturn state. For this warmth, or fire, as we call it in occultism, reveals itself to us in its spiritual substrata. And as we have seen, spiritual actions, spiritual accomplishments, were in fact occurring on ancient Saturn. We have tried to make a picture of what kind of spiritual activity was occurring on ancient Saturn. We said that the spirits of will, the thrones, performed deeds of sacrifice. This means that if we look back upon what took place on Saturn, we see the cherubim and the sacrifice that flowed from the thrones. Sacrifice flowed from the thrones to the cherubim, and these acts of sacrifice appear, when viewed from the outside, as warmth. Conditions of warmth are thus the outer physical expression of sacrifice. Indeed, wherever we perceive warmth in the entire cosmos, this warmth is the outward expression of what stands behind it. Warmth is an illusion. Acts of sacrifice by spiritual beings are the reality behind the warmth. If we wish to characterize warmth accurately, therefore, we must say, cosmic warmth is the revelation of cosmic sacrifice, or cosmic acts of sacrifice. Then we have seen, too, that as the thrones present their sacrificial deed to the cherubim, what we call time is simultaneously born. I have already mentioned that time is a modern word that does not quite fit what I am trying to describe. Time here does not yet encompass the abstractions earlier and later as we perceive them today. Time began as a configuration of spiritual beings, the spirits of personality, also identified as time spirits. These time spirits are really the ancient manifestation of time, the offspring of the thrones and cherubim. But the circumstances under which the beings of the time aspect originated in ancient Saturn are deeds of sacrifice. If we wish to reach a true understanding of what stands behind the warmth, when it is said that ancient Saturn consists of warmth, we must not adopt merely outwardly physical concepts. Remember that warmth, as we use the term, is a physical concept. Instead, we must adopt concepts derived from the life of the soul, the moral, wisdom-filled life of the soul. No one can know what warmth is who cannot imagine what it means to sacrifice willingly what one possesses, what one has, even what one is. One must come to understand what it means, from the perspective of the soul, to offer up one's own being, to renounce oneself consciously. In other words, one must imagine giving one's best for the healing of the world, not holding one's best for the sake of self, but wanting to sacrifice one's best at the altar of cosmic all. If we grasp all this as living concept, and as a feeling permeating our soul, it can lead us gradually to understand what stands behind the appearance of warmth. Try to imagine what is connected with the concept of sacrifice in modern life, namely that it is inconceivable that a person who sacrifices with understanding does so against his or her will. If someone sacrifices against his or her will, the person must have felt pressed to do so. There must have been coercion. But that is not at all what is meant by sacrifice here. Here, sacrifice flows, as a matter of course, from the being who offers it. If someone sacrifices without external coercion or the expectation of achieving something, if someone sacrifices out of an inner sense of urgency, then that person will experience inner warmth and bliss. When we feel a glow with inner warmth and happiness, this expresses something we can only describe by saying that a person who offers a sacrifice and feels permeated with warmth glows with happiness. We ourselves can experience how the glow of sacrifice approaches us in the illusion of external warmth in the world. Only a person who can grasp that, where there is warmth in the world, there is an underlying soul spiritual reality, truly understands what warmth is. Warmth exists and becomes active through the joy of sacrifice. Whoever can experience warmth in this way gradually arrives at the reality that exists or lies hidden behind the phenomenon, the illusion of physical warmth. If now we wish to press forward from ancient Saturn existence to ancient Sun existence, we must lay the basis for concepts with which to create an image of the substance of ancient Sun, not our present Sun. Once again, and in an outline of occult science, I presented only the outward appearance. Ancient Sun enhanced warmth by adding air and light to it. Just as we had to search beyond warmth to perceive the glow of sacrifice brought about by the spirits of will, so too now, if we wish to understand the air and light that were added to warmth on ancient Sun, we must look for something moral as the essence of air and light. Only if we look for what we can experience within ourselves in a soul spiritual way, can we arrive at an idea, a representation, a feeling of the air and light on ancient Sun. We can describe this feeling as a soul experience in the following way. Imagine that you observed a genuine deed of sacrifice, or imagined the thrones presenting their sacrifice to the cherubim, as we described it in the last lecture, and that you were so moved by this picture of sacrifice that it enlivened your soul with bliss. What would your soul feel if you were to observe such sacrificing beings, or if you were to imagine a picture of this kind that awakened and enlivened your soul. If you have feelings full of life, if you cannot stand unfeelingly before the delight one feels in a deed of sacrifice, you would have to experience a profound awakening at the sight of this act of sacrifice. You would have to feel in your soul that to gaze upon the supreme happiness that arises from sacrifice is the most beautiful deed, the most beautiful experience that could ever arise in the soul. Another feeling that would arise is an attitude of complete surrender. Indeed, you would have to be a block of wood if sacrifice did not create a longing in the soul to gaze upon it with absolute devotion and convey a mood of self-surrender. Consider such selfless giving over of oneself. A deed of sacrifice is active. It is self-surrender transformed in activity. And contemplation of active, concerned self-surrender can create an affinity for the giving over of oneself, for losing oneself, for forgetting about self. If we cannot create such a mood, or at least an inkling or an echo of it, we can never truly come to a closer understanding of sacrifice. Indeed, if we pour this mood of disinterested giving up of self into the soul, we may reach what a higher form of knowledge can give us. A person who is unable to create a spirit of self-surrender cannot achieve higher knowledge. What is the opposite of this attitude of self-surrender? It is self-will, the assertion of one's own will. These are two poles in the soul's life: loss of self in what one is contemplating, and self-willed assertion of what lies within the self. These are two great opposites. If you wish to attain real knowledge and permeate yourself with wisdom, self-will is lethal. In ordinary life, we know self-will only as prejudice, and prejudices always destroy higher insight. In fact, one must intensify in one's thinking what I am describing here as capacity for self-surrender. For only through an intensified sense of self-surrender can a human being work toward the higher worlds. In the higher worlds, one must be able to experience the capacity to lose oneself, at least as a mood of soul. Let me emphasize here that we can never attain higher knowledge if we work only with ordinary scientific knowledge or everyday thinking. We must be clear that ordinary science and everyday thinking work out of ordinary human will, through all that self-will has created in the experiences, feelings, and ideas we have inherited or cultivated. We can be misled here. Indeed, delusions are very common in this area. People come, for example, and say, "We are supposed to accept this or that aspect of knowledge presented by spiritual science, but I will not accept anything that is not consistent with what I already think. I won't accept anything without proof." Certainly, one should accept nothing without evidence. But if we take from what is presented to us only what we already know, we cannot advance a step. Anyone wishing to become clairvoyant will never say that he or she will accept only what he or she has already proved. Those who wish to become clairvoyant must be absolutely free from all self-seeking, and know in advance that all that comes to them from the cosmos can only be described by the word grace. Such people anticipate everything and anything from illuminating grace. For how does one achieve clairvoyant knowledge? Only by setting aside everything we have already learned. Ordinarily we think, "I have my own judgment." But we must remember that ordinary judgment only comes out of renewing what your ancestors once thought, or what stimulates your desires, and so on. It is never a question of making one's own judgments. Those who most insist that they are exercising their own judgment are the least aware how slavishly they are tied to their own prejudices. All of this must be eliminated if we wish to attain higher knowledge. The soul must be empty and quietly able to wait for what it can receive out of the spaceless, timeless, objectless, eventless, secret, hidden world. On no account should we believe that we can acquire higher knowledge unless we allow to ripen within us a mood out of which we meet all that is offered to us as revelation or enlightenment, illumination. Only in this mood can we await whatever approaches us and gives us something as nothing other than grace, as what should come to us. How does such knowledge reveal itself? How is what comes to us revealed when we have sufficiently prepared ourselves? It reveals itself as a feeling of being blessed by a gift from the spiritual world that comes to meet us. If we wished to describe what stands before us in life in this way, full of blessing and filling us with this recognition, be it a being or anything else, we would express it only as follows. We experience what comes to us as bestowing a blessing, as granting a gift, as giving us something. To grasp the nature of a being, whose main characteristic consists of the capacity for granting, giving, offering, for showering and pouring forth blessings, to grasp such a nature, we would need to grasp the image of the sacrifice of the thrones to the cherubim. Imagine that a being came to someone who understood the meaning of the thrones sacrificed to the cherubim, a being who would transform the capacity to understand the thrones sacrifice into a capacity to give, to pour one's gifts around oneself in blessing. Imagine that we were looking at a rose and are delighted by it, thus experiencing the feeling of being blessed by something we see as beautiful. Then imagine another being who, by comprehending the significance of the throne's sacrifice to the cherubim, could confer all that it had on its surroundings, pouring everything available into the world in the spirit of giving. If we imagine such beings, then we have those spirits of wisdom described in An Outline of Occult Science, who during sun existence were added to those we came to know during Saturn existence. Now, if I were to ask what is the character of these spirits of wisdom who appeared during sun existence and were added to the spirits already present during the Saturn existence, I would have to answer as follows. These spirits have as their defining characteristic the virtue of giving, of bestowing, of effecting blessings. If I wanted to find a designation for these beings, I would have to say they are the spirits of wisdom, the mighty granters, the great givers of the cosmos. Just as we have called the thrones the great sacrificers, so we have to say of the spirits of wisdom that they are the great givers who grant their gift, which is the same gift as that out of which the cosmos is woven and lives, for they themselves streamed out into the cosmos and first created order. That is the effect of the spirits of wisdom on the sun. They give their own beings into their surroundings. But what, we may ask, happens on the sun if we want to see with higher sense perception what is represented to outer observation? When we look at the sun, we observe what is described in An Outline of Occult Science. In addition to warmth, the sun also consists of air and light. But to say simply that the sun consists of air and light as well as of warmth is the same as saying, for example, of landscape, in the distance I see a gray cloud. If one were a painter and had this impression, one would paint a gray cloud. But if one were to approach it more closely, one would perhaps find something like a swarm of insects rather than a grey cloud. Actually, what seemed like a grey cloud was a number of living beings. We are in a similar situation when we consider ancient sun existence from a distance. From afar, ancient sun appears to be a body consisting of air and light. But if we look at it more closely, we no longer see a body of air and light. Instead, there appears the great virtue of bestowing by the spirits of wisdom. No one discovers the true nature of air who merely describes air according to outward physical properties. These properties are only illusion, maya, external manifestations. Wherever there is air in the universe, the actions of the gift-granting spirits of wisdom lie behind it. Weaving, working air reveals the virtue of bestowing by the spirits of the macrocosm. Only the person who sees the true nature of air says, "I perceive here the element of air." But in reality, the spirits of wisdom are placing their gifts into their surroundings. Something streams into the environment from the spirits of wisdom. Thus we know now what we have really said about ancient sun when we say that it consists of air. We know now that what appears outwardly as air is actually the activity of the spirits of wisdom, allowing their own being to flow forth into their surroundings. But at this point, something remarkable presents itself to clairvoyant vision on the ancient sun. To understand this, we must become clear how, out of the life of the soul, we can create an even more accurate idea of the virtue of bestowing. Let us recreate a feeling, such as we can have when we are able to permeate ourselves with a perception or an idea in the mood of sacrifice that we have described here. An idea so permeated always gives us a particular feeling. It is not like a scientific idea. The most similar experience may be found in the artistic realm, where, in order to give the world an independent entity, an idea must master the way in which color or form streams out into the world. To characterize a being who has the capacity to give such a gift, one may say that productivity, creativity, is bound up with this gift, for the act itself of giving is a creative activity. Whoever has an idea and feels that the idea can bring healing into the world, and then presents it in works of art, has rightly understood the fruits of the virtue of bestowing. Think of a creative idea in the mind of the artist, and how it then becomes manifest in matter. This idea is actually a spiritual being of air. Where air exists, we face creative activity, and because this living creativity existed on the sun, the association of air with creative ability is identifiable as fact. If we recall that the spirits of time were born on ancient Saturn, we also know that time existed on the sun, for time came over to the sun from Saturn. Time existed there. Because the archetypal bestowing arose, a possibility existed on ancient Sun that could not have occurred on ancient Saturn. Consider what would have become of giving if time had not existed. There would be no bestowing, for giving consists both of giving and receiving. Without receiving, giving is inconceivable. Thus, giving consists of two acts, giving and receiving. Otherwise, giving has no purpose. On the sun, giving stands in a most unusual relation to receiving. Because time already exists on the sun, the gift sent into the surroundings of the ancient sun is preserved in time. When the spirits of wisdom pour out their gifts, they remain present in time. Something must then enter that is capable of receiving. In relationship to the activity of the spirits of wisdom, receiving occurs at a later point in time. The spirits of wisdom give at an earlier moment, and what is necessarily bound up with their giving as receiving occurs at a later point in time. To gain an accurate picture of this, once again we must take the experience of our own soul into account. Imagine that you have tried very hard to understand something or to formulate some thought. Now you have created this thought. The next day you clear your mind, so that everything that you created in your thoughts on the previous day can be brought back to mind. Thus you receive today what was formulated yesterday. So it was on the ancient sun. What was given at an earlier point in time remained preserved, and then was received at a later moment. But what was the significance of this receiving? Like the archetypal giving, receiving too is a deed or event on the ancient sun. Receiving differentiates itself from giving only in terms of time. Receiving occurs later. The giving comes from the spirits of wisdom, but who receives? Before someone can receive, there first must be a recipient. In the same way that the sacrifice of the thrones to the cherubim brought about the birth of the spirits of time on Saturn, the birth of bestowing in the universe by the spirits of wisdom on the sun created those spirits we call archangels or archangeloi. The archangels are the ones who receive on the ancient sun. But they receive in a very special manner, for what the archangels receive from the spirits of wisdom, they do not keep for themselves. Rather, they reflect it back, just as a mirror reflects back the image it receives. Thus the archangels on the sun have the task of receiving what was given at an earlier point in time, so that it is preserved and reflected again by the archangels into a later time. Therefore on the sun we have an earlier act of giving and a later act of receiving. But a receiving in the form of a streaming or reflecting back of what was given at the earlier point in time. Imagine that the earth were not as it currently is, but that what had happened during an earlier time could stream once again into the present. We know that something like that actually occurs. We live in the fifth post-Atlantean cultural epoch, and the events of the third post-Atlantean cultural period, the ancient Egypto-Chaldean era, stream into this period. What occurred during the third epoch will re-emerge and be reflected back again. That is a recapitulation of the giving and receiving that occurred during the ancient sun development. Thus we may think of the spirits of wisdom as the bestowers in ancient sun times, and the archangels as the receivers. Something quite remarkable arises from this, which you can represent accurately only by imagining an inwardly enclosed globe from whose center radiates something to be given away. Something radiates out from the center to the periphery, and from there reflects back to the middle point. From within the outer surface of the globe, the archangels radiate back what they have received. From the outside, you need not imagine anything. We must imagine something moving out from the center that comes from the spirits of wisdom. It radiates in all directions and is received by the archangels who reflect it back again. What is it that reflects back into space? What is this gift of the spirits of wisdom that radiates back again? What is the radiating wisdom that is directed back to its source? It is light. The archangels are also the creators of light. Light is not at all what it appears to be, an outward illusion. Where light occurs, the gifts of the spirits of wisdom are radiating back to us. And the beings whose existence we must presume wherever there is light are the archangels. Thus, we must say, the archangels are hidden within the flooding rays of light. Behind the flooding rays of light that come to us, the archangels are hidden. The archangels' capacity to stream forth light arises out of the virtue of bestowing that is radiated to them by the spirits of wisdom. We thus arrive at a picture of the old sun. Imagine a center where the spirits of wisdom are immersed in their contemplation of the legacy from ancient Saturn, the deed of sacrifice of the thrones to the cherubim. Contemplating this deed of sacrifice causes the spirits of wisdom to radiate the substance of their own being, to radiate streaming, flowing wisdom in the form of the virtue of bestowing. Because this virtue is permeated by time, it is sent forth and then reflected back again, so that we have before us a globe illumined within by virtue reflected back to its source and center. For we must imagine that the ancient sun illuminates in an inward, not an outward, direction, and this creates something new that we can describe in the following way. Imagine these spirits of wisdom, seated at the center of the sun, contemplating the sacrificing thrones and radiating their own being far out into their surroundings. Then, from the surface of the globe, they receive back what they radiated forth in the form of light. Everything is illuminated through and through. But what do they receive from what radiates back to them? Their own being, their innermost being, has been surrendered as a gift to the macrocosm. Now it radiates back. Their own being returns to them from the outside. They see their own inner being distributed throughout the cosmos and radiated back as light, as the reflection of their own being. Inner and outer are the two opposites that now come before us. The earlier and the later transform themselves and become the inner and the outer. Space is born. Out of the gift of the virtue of bestowing, given by the spirits of wisdom, space arises on the old sun. Before this, space could have only allegorical meaning. Now, however, on the old sun, we actually have space, but only in two dimensions. There are no above and below, no right and left, only outer and inner. Actually, these two opposites already emerge at the end of ancient Saturn, but they recapitulate the process in the creation of space on ancient Sun. And if we want to imagine all of these occurrences again, just as previously we brought before our soul the sacrificing thrones giving birth to the time spirits, we would not portray a body consisting of light, for light does not yet radiate outward, but exists only as reflection radiating inward. Rather, we must imagine a globe as inner space. At its center, a recapitulation of the picture of Saturn occurs. The thrones present as spirits kneeling before the cherubim. Let me read that all again. At its center, a recapitulation of the picture of Saturn occurs. The thrones, present as spirits kneeling before the cherubim, those winged beings who offer their own being, and in addition to these, the spirits of wisdom immersed in contemplation of the sacrifice. Now one can imagine that the glow lying within the sacrifice, the sacrificial fire of the thrones, transforms itself into the sacrifice of the spirits of wisdom. Their sacrifice is represented materially as air that rises during the act of sacrifice as sacrificial smoke. Thus we have a complete picture, if we imagine. The sacrificing thrones kneeling before the cherubim. the choirs of spirits of wisdom surrendering in devotion to the vision of the sacrifice of the thrones at the center of the sun. Their devotion growing into an image of sacrificial smoke, which spreads out in all directions, streams outward, condenses into clouds at the periphery. The archangels being created out of the clouds of smoke, the gift of the sacrificial smoke radiating back from the periphery in the form of light. The light illuminating the interior of the sun. The gift of the spirits of wisdom being given back, thereby creating the sphere of the sun. This sphere consists of the outpoured gifts of glowing warmth and sacrificial smoke. At the outer periphery sit the archangels, the creators of light, who reflect what earlier came into being on the sun. It took time, but eventually sacrificial smoke could return as light. What were the archangels preserving? They preserved what arose earlier, the gifts of the spirits of wisdom that the archangels received and then radiated back. But what previously existed as time, they gave back as space. And by radiating back time as space, the archangels gave back what they themselves had received from the Archai. Thus, they become the angels of beginning, because they brought what existed earlier into a later time. Archangels, messengers of beginning. It is remarkable when out of true occult knowledge a word such as this re-emerges, and when we recall how this word, arising in the most ancient traditions, has been passed on to us through the school of Dionysus the Areopagite, the pupil of Paul, it is remarkable to see that this word is so deeply imprinted that when we discover it again, independently of what was written, what originally arose, the original meaning, arises again. That fills us with the greatest respect. We feel linked to the ancient holy mystery schools of initiation wisdom. It is as if this ancient tradition were streaming into us, for we grasp it with understanding, even though we ourselves are responsible for acquiring this knowledge independently of the old tradition. Those who can experience something of the mood of the ancient forms of expression that have been handed down to us, even though they may be unaware of these traditions, feel themselves placed under the influence of the time spirits within the human spirit. A wonderful feeling of being linked with the whole of human evolution arises from this, a feeling of certainty in these matters. The archangels preserve the recollection of the archetypal beginnings. Whatever existed on one or another of the planets is recapitulated at a later time, but something else is always added to the later manifestation. Thus, in a certain way, we also meet the being of the sun in what we find on our own earth. This entire imagination, this whole feeling that we can develop, gives us an image of the sacrificing thrones, of the cherubim receiving their offering, of the glow radiating from the sacrifice, of the sacrificial smoke spreading out like air, of the light radiating back from the archangels who preserve what occurred in the beginning for a later time. This feeling can awaken in us an understanding of everything related to these creations. This milieu, which I have portrayed here as a milieu of the soul, presents from a more spiritual perspective what we earlier attained through a physical representation. And we shall now see that it is out of this milieu that the being is born who appeared on the earth as the Christ being. We can understand what the Christ being brought to the earth only if we assimilate the concept of the grace engendering virtue of bestowing, as it reflects in the light of the cosmos into the inner substance of the sun body, which is permeated and illuminated by this light. If we hold up this image, which we have just described, transform it into an imagination, and consider that this is what this being brought to and embodied on earth, then we will be able to experience more deeply the spiritual being of the Christ impulse. We will be able to understand the dim inkling that can live in the human soul when it senses that what has just been described by this representation can live again on earth. Let us imagine that what we have just described of the sun was gathered up and concentrated completely in the soul of a being, and then, at a later time, brought forward again. Imagine that this being appeared on earth and worked in such a way that out of what the archetypal deed and smoke of sacrifice created, that is, the light engendering time and the bestowing virtue, an extract of activating grace would be carried over and reflect soul warmth and glorious light out of the cosmos. Imagine all of this concentrated in a single soul, who in turn gives this to the earth existence, and that assembled around this soul are those who are intended to radiate this back and preserve it for the remainder of earth existence. In the center is the One who bestows out of the sacrifice and through sacrifice. Around this being are those who are intended to receive it. Here we have linked together on the one hand what the sacrifice is and what belongs to it, translated into earthly existence, and on the other hand the possibility of destroying this sacrifice for everything that can be given to the human being to bring about grace may be either rejected or accepted. Imagine that all of this were embodied in an intuition. Then one would have what one experiences standing before Leonardo da Vinci's Last Supper. Here we have the entire sun, together with the beings of sacrifice, the beings of bestowing virtue, the beings of soul-warming bliss and light-filled splendor, as grasped by the soul, radiated back from the ones who have been chosen to preserve what arises in earlier times for later times. All this has been set out especially for the earth, together with the possibility that it can also be rejected by the betrayer. The being of the earth, insofar as the sun being reappears on the earth, can be experienced in this way. If this is felt not in an outward intellectual manner, but in a truly artistic way, one can experience the real driving force in such a work of art that reflects an extract of earth existence. And if next time we see this picture, we notice how the Christ grows out of the sun milieu, then we will understand more fully what we have often said, that if a spirit came down from Mars to the earth and could not understand everything he saw, that spirit would still be able to understand the mission of the earth if he allowed Leonardo's Last Supper to work upon him. An inhabitant of Mars would be able to see that sun existence must be concealed within earth existence, and everything that we could say about the significance of this for the earth would be clear to him. That inhabitant of Mars would understand that the earth has meaning, and that what was significant for the earth, that inhabitant of Mars would understand that the earth has meaning, and know what was significant for the earth. He would say to himself, this could occur somewhere on earth, and have meaning only for a corner of the earth's existence, but if this deed could really be represented, the deed that streams toward me out of the colors of the central figure in relation to the surrounding figures, then I would feel what the spirits of wisdom experienced on the sun, echoing again here in the words, do this in remembrance of me. Here is the preservation of the earlier in the later. We will only understand these words when we grasp them in the context of the entire cosmos, as we have just learned to do. Here I just wanted to point out how an artistic deed of the first rank stands in relationship to the entire development of the cosmos. In the next lecture, it will be our task to understand the Christ being from the perspective of the spiritual being of the sun, in order to go on to the perspective of the spiritual being of the moon. The end of lecture 2.